and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, joined by Jason Yannakopoulos this week. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11am here on BCFM 93.2. This week, the Energy Exploration Dome. We go exploring energy and lighting. Also, we look at Iraq. Britain has been accused of war crimes in Iraq. And we go and speak to somebody from 2005 who's a family half Bristolian and half Iraqi. Jason Yannakopoulos and I will be reviewing some news stories, including the floods and the Freemasons. But we start this week with Houri Beto. Is that, have I pronounced that right, Houri?
Sorry, Betui.
Betui, I'm sorry. You are actually living in Bristol now, and you have been for how long?
About just over 8 years now.
Okay, and but you're originally from Iran. Now, we hear a lot about Iran on the news. One thing we don't hear is what kind of country it is. So when you came to Britain, what did you notice that was different here, and what things stood out to you about the UK?
Obviously the people, and because I used to cover up in Iran, so when I first came here it was really different to be able to like not to wear my scarf when I go out. I'm not a religion person, but it was just difficult to be able to like reveal myself.
So that must be a bit difficult in Iran, because you've got some people who think that it's important to maybe cover your hair, women particularly, obviously. And so did you feel when you were in Iran that it was a bit, you know, you didn't really like to be like that?
Yeah, it's just obviously take away your freedom. It's a really hot country, so it is really difficult, especially if you're wearing a dark colour one in the summer, which is like nearly 50 degrees. And I only used to wear when I used to go out, which most people do, and like yeah, you have to wear.
Okay,
you don't have the option not to.
I mean, do you find that there's a bit of fashion freedom now that you can sort of just wear what you want, do what you want a bit more?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it is like that. You do have that in Iran. That people don't cover up; they do show bits of their hair. Headscarf is like accessories now. It's becoming like a fashion. It does look nice when you wear it, but obviously when the weather is really hot, you just want to get rid of it.
Okay, is there anything you miss about Iran though, having been over here for such a long time?
Yeah, the weather is it's lovely over there. Sunshine. And the Caspian Sea, I love it. My granddad used to have a villa there, and we used to go there every summer. And since he passed away, we never, like, because he always reminded of him, we never used to go.
But what was that, swimming? What's the Caspian Sea like? Most of us have never been there.
It is really salty water. You go in there, your eyes just start to, like, watering. And it is really warm and humid there. You don't find that in Tehran as a capital. It's really dry, but as you go towards the Caspian Sea, it gets really humid.
Now, it might sound like a silly question, but if you're swimming in the Caspian Sea, how do you keep yourself covered up?
Well, it's like it's kind of private now.
Okay, so that's not considered as public. So it was maybe your relative's own private space. So you didn't have to have some sort of headscarf while you're swimming through the sea.
Well, it's not private. It's public, but you can't really get to it. And people do get to it, but it's a bit. You do have a bit of freedom over there. You do go in the sea with the swimming costume.
But
they could come with a boat, and you just have to run away.
Swim.
I know. Swim away.
Okay, now yeah. When was the last time you were back in Iran then?
I went back in August. September. I was there
last year. Okay, yeah. And how have things changed? Do you think things have changed much, or give us an idea of what you were up to and what was the lie of the land in Iran and what's different there from here?
I mainly go and visit my mom and my family, but people seem quite I don't want to say depressed, but worried about what's going to happen. And and all you hear, or they talk about how expensive everything is, and even food is like, from last time I was there, which was 2 years ago, 2011, and like it's amazing how expensive everything has
got. Well,
this
is probably the sanctions, isn't it? Because they're putting sanctions on. Yeah, it seems a shame, really, that people around the world can't kind of get on and live with each other together easily. Is it easy? Say, for example, if I wanted to go and visit Iran, is it a fairly easy thing to do? Because, I mean, I'm thinking to myself, I'd quite like to. Before you get, you know, McDonald's everywhere, if the Americans take over, as they seem to want to do everywhere. I mean, they put McDonald's here in the 1970s. You know, but everywhere in the world, it seems as if there's not a McDonald's there, the Americans want to take it over.
Yeah.
So is it fairly easy to travel as it is at the moment?
They have made it difficult. I had a daughter recently. I've got one. The first time taking her to Iran, I had to get a passport for her, and it was really difficult. I mean, she's three-quarter Iranian, so her dad is half Iranian. But it was really difficult. We got there with an English passport, because she didn't have Iranian passport, so they took the English passport away, and they said we won't give it to you till you get one. So the whole time I was there, for the first 2 weeks or 3 weeks, me and my dad had to go and get a passport for it, which was a real pain.
Oh, it's annoying, isn't it, to have all this bureaucracy to go through?
Yeah.
Just to go and visit a country, it seems a bit strange and irritating. But how do the people in Iran cope with all the sort of gloom that's over there? Because it sounds a real shame that there's this kind of, the Americans, and I'm afraid the British too, at least the TV and the politicians, seem to project a lot of bad thoughts onto Iran. How do people deal with the sort of depressing idea that the Americans are constantly having a go at them, challenging them, saying, you've got to change? How do ordinary people deal with that?
I think people are quite happy to change, to be honest with you. But they don't have any choice. They do have to adapt themselves.
Okay. Finally, if you're staying here in Bristol, you've just had a child. Obviously, you may not be. What kind of stuff have you been doing? You're doing some studying now, but what was it that brought you to Bristol in the first place?
I met my husband and I came here.
Where did you meet him? Did you meet him in Iran?
In Iran. His dad is Iranian, so he was visiting at the time. And I came here with him.
And what is it that you like about the city, about Bristol?
Oh, I love Bristol. I love the people. Really, really nice city. I love museum and everything.
Okay. Do you get involved in the social life? Do you go out much with your husband? Do you go out and about much? Do you find that the city has got a kind of a bit of a life that you might not get in a, you know, sort of out in Iran or somewhere which is a little bit more controlled?
You do get that a lot in Iran, but I find it really child friendly here. They have made it really easy for people with children to be able to go out, more places for them available, and it definitely is.
Okay, well, Houri, sorry to grill you so much, but it's just lovely to hear your perspective, an outside perspective on life here in Bristol. Houri
Betui.
Betui. Houri Betui. Thanks ever so much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
So it's that time of year again when we're a bit prone to feeling the January blues. And on top of that, a whopping 80% of us have by now broken most of the New Year's resolutions we set ourselves. So where are we all going so wrong? Maybe we're setting our goals too high and are doomed to failure. Or are we looking for happiness in the wrong places? Who knows? Perhaps it's time for a rethink before we all come too demoralised and hand back our shiny new gym memberships before we've even broken a sweat. If you're one of the failed majority, or whatever the case, don't despair, as I'm joined in the studio today by Lou Jones, who's been delving a bit deeper into this subject and hopefully can shed some light on the whole matter in hand by looking at how our ancestors and even ancient philosophers dealt with the subject, how some of it might be helpful in the modern day pursuit of happiness. So, Lou, welcome to Dialect.
Thank you.
How is this idea of making New Year's resolutions old-fashioned? Apparently, it goes back quite a long way.
Well, from the research that I've recently done, it turns out that it actually dates back to the ancient Babylonians. They were the first people really who embraced this concept of new beginnings at this sort of time of year. And they would make promises to their gods and do such things as return borrowed objects, pay off any debts they had, obviously not a bad idea. And then the Romans continued with it. And an interesting fact that I uncovered was that knights in medieval times would take what was known as a peacock vow at this time, and that would basically reaffirm their commitment to chivalry, which is a bit of a lost art these days, really.
So the Babylonians, that's about, I think, isn't it, 1000 BC or something, right the way through to medieval times with the knights.
Right.
But it's difficult to compare those resolutions with ones people make today, isn't it?
It is, I think, mainly because the ancient civilizations and the times that they were living in, the resolutions were probably there mainly to benefit their society, rather than them being allowed to focus on their own individual needs, which is what we seem to be doing more today. But, I mean, as far as the partying aspect and the celebratory aspect, the Babylonians really beat us hands down. They took 12 days and nights to celebrate. So, in terms of a dry January, that'll probably be out of the question for most of them.
So, back to the modern day, what are we hoping to achieve by making these resolutions?
Well, the usual ones come up, Tony, like the obvious ones, fitness, money matters, going to change my job, stop smoking, learn a new language.
People make the same resolutions year after year. So from those resolutions, I suppose we get a good idea of what people are looking for in happiness. Mm. Can you shed any light on how that compares to the stuff we were talking about earlier, the old ancient civilization and the medieval times?
Well, I found it quite fascinating to look back to ancient Greece for this and dug a bit deeper again to what the philosophers of the day would have to say on it. Because obviously they were the speakers of the day and they would be the ones in society who would name the problems and give us, you know, advice on how our life should be. If you take someone like Aristotle, who we're all fairly familiar with the name, and he had the most to say on about happiness than any of the philosophers of his day. He had some pretty interesting ideas on that.
Okay, but I mean, it's not just about happiness, is it? Resolutions. Sometimes you're doing something which isn't going to make you happy. I mean, say, for example, giving up smoking. Mm. That's not necessarily going to make you happy. You're going to be probably grinding your teeth for months on end.
Mm. Well, I mean, if you allow me to bring in some of his arguments, perhaps, to sort of highlight that, it kind of turns the whole idea of happiness on its head, given the fact that Aristotle, as I've discovered, saw happiness as a final goal or as a sum total of our lives rather than chasing the moment, if you
right,
like.
Right, so there's going to be pain on the way.
Exactly, and, you know, he wanted us to see our lives as a whole journey towards the end result of happiness rather than having the quick fixes. And, I mean, he gives us other information as well to achieve this. I mean, this is a theme that will come up in
quick fixes. I'm listening. Go for it.
Right. Well, he's against the quick fix, unfortunately.
Oh, no.
Instant gratification in his eyes would be a very poor choice. He recommends some seriously well thought out long term choices. Usually the harder option is more preferable than the easy option. It might require some sacrifice for us, but it'd be better in the long run. He also is keen to point out sort of moral character, how important that is, the fact you need to be courageous, fight for justice, work hard on your friendships, and also be involved in citizenship in our life, such as these days you may translate that as working within the community or being involved in local issues and things that get us out there in contact with other people. So really not a huge difference between what might do you good now and what would have done you good all those years ago.
So he didn't have much truck with the "it's nothing to do with me" types. How well do you think, though, these theories translate into today?
Well, there's a bit of a clash between his theories and the way we lead our lives today. We're all about instant solutions, really, aren't we, with the technological society that we're in. But, you know, we could take a leaf out of his book and see our lives as more of a long journey to gain happiness rather than constantly looking for the quick fix. And there's always some wisdom to be taken from the past, and perhaps we can put that into our future and look at things in a slightly different angle. Wouldn't harm.
I think you're right. Getting rid of some of this short-termism.
Exactly.
Okay, Louise Jones, thanks very much. And there will be plenty of us out there who may have removed those lists by now, thank goodness. But on a more reflective note, I think it was Mark Twain who said, "There's no such thing as a new idea. We give them a turn and they make new and curious combinations." And I think that sums it up quite well here with what you're saying, in that old schools of thought can sometimes have a lot of relevance today. But each society and culture seems to live by its own rules, really. Maybe it would be wise to take a step back and try and learn something new from them. Either way, it's been great to explore the subject with you, Louise Jones. Do come back and enlighten us again.
Thank you. We'd love to.
Thanks. Bristol Community FM 93.2. Now, you'll find them at festivals all over the country, both last year and this coming year. They're called the Green Energy Exploration Dome, and I had a chat with Ben and Dave.
I'm Ben Kavanagh. And I'm from Gloucestershire, and I'm interested in dome building and alternative forms of energy, and exploring them and skilling myself up and exploring with other people how that happens.
Well, we're stood in one of your geodesic domes now. It's a little bit higgledy-piggledy with the canvas. You seem to have sort of got lots of different tarpaulins and stuck them together, but you can do that with a dome, can't you? Because there's all sorts of different places you can tie it. First of all, tell us about the geodesic dome. What attracts you about these structures?
I just love the form and the geometric shape of the thing, and the different ways you can make geodesic domes, and I've loved them for a long time, and then I started building them.
Now, it looks very complicated to put up. There's all sorts of triangles in lots of different directions and shapes, sort of hexagons and things. So is it actually quite complicated when it comes to putting the thing up?
Once you put it up, there's a nice diagram that we've drawn up, and you learn different ways.
You've got colour coding, I can see there.
We have, and that's why the struts are painted in the colours of the diagram, so it's relatively easy. And there's lots of different ways to put them up. Lots of different people have different ways, but actually it's not that difficult.
Now, it's about, I suppose, 10 feet, maybe 12 feet high. It's actually a lovely piece of space, and it's as big as a very large kind of living room space. Now, let's talk about what you've actually got in here, because you've got your bicycle there attached to what looks like a little generator. What's going on here?
Yeah, this is a bicycle generator using a road bike, which hasn't been adapted at all, on an exercise stand. And we've got a small golf buggy motor, which is being used as a dynamo, and it's generating about 100 watts of electricity if you're fit and keep going for a while.
And what about all this that's connected to it? I can see there what looks like a USB port. So is this the idea? You're able to charge things like laptops, mobiles, that kind of thing?
Yeah, any of these power generation. We've got a wind generator outside, and we've got various solar panels, and we've got battery banks. But you're able to then do anything you want to. You can have an inverter and run household appliances, or you can charge phones or run LED lights. Like, the whole dome here is lit with 20 watts of light. LED lights, very low powered lights. But basically, you could go off grid with this. You could run a fridge. You could do anything you wanted to.
But you'd have to sit pedalling quite a lot to keep your fridge going.
Oh, that's if you use the bicycle generator. I mean, obviously, your bicycle generator is really more for emergencies. Really, if you're going to go off-grid, solar panels and a wind generator are the way that you're going to produce the bulk of your power.
I think for most people, though, off-grid is a bit too far to go. Is there a sort of halfway house between, using, the local electricity board, or there are these private companies nowadays with their smart meters, but is there a halfway house between going slightly off-grid? Because most people, obviously, living even in the countryside, they would find it that they can't actually generate enough electricity themselves to supply their needs.
Yes, I mean, I think one of the things that we're exploring is doing a halfway house. So some people are concerned that at some point, if things go wrong, the national grid might fall over and something like that might happen. So, for instance, if you have had one of those roof panel systems put in, which is feeding into the national grid, you could have a small bank of 12-volt batteries, charge them up during the day when you're getting free electricity, and have a few 12-volt lights through your house, and then you're ready to go. So you'd be future-proof. So if the grid ever fell over, your panels could then charge your battery bank and you're ready to go.
Yeah, but you'd be looking at it running down. And so what you'd be doing, as soon as your lighting and things like that started to go down, you might have to jump on your bike.
The bike would be for cold winter weeks like this last winter, where we had long periods of cloud and cold, and your solar and wind might not generate quite enough. And if you needed to charge your phone or do something, you could generate enough by cycling the bike, and it would keep you warm, and you'd have to have the fire on less.
So, to what extent is this a hobby, and to what extent is it actually any practical use?
For me, it's a passion, but it's a practical use in the fact that if you do want to help with the energy needs of the country, for a start, if you have solar panels and that sort of thing, and you're feeding into the national grid, you're reducing the requirement for a new horrible gas-powered power stations, etc. One of the reasons why we're exploring this here is for people to get an idea of just how much power we actually use in the home every day. And if we could reduce our power usage dramatically, we'd reduce the need for any more power stations. And fracking is just ridiculous. It's like a total destruction of part of our world to get a tiny little bit of energy out. And nuclear, again, we're just getting a little bit of energy and leaving huge possibility of destruction in the future.
Now, you said you're based in Cirencester in Gloucestershire. You are the Green Energy Exploration Dome.
Please come and tell us what your solutions have been that you've found.
Just been chatting with Ben, Dave. Now you're also in this Green Energy Exploration Dome, and you've got lots of LEDs. LED fantastic. You're obviously into these. Why?
They are the most efficient lighting that exists at the present time. They are often at least 90% more efficient than incandescent equivalents. LEDs are rated at between 30 and 50, sometimes 100,000 hours. So you could use them for 8 hours a day for 18 years.
Crikey. What about what you've done here? It looks like these sort of quite nice spidery looking projections with several little bulbs in them. What you've done in a way is you've created quite a nice space with all sorts of different coloured lighting. Is this actually fairly simple and cheap to do for anyone that wants this kind of lighting?
It's on a total sliding scale. We run workshops where we'll teach you to make these LED tentacles or various other LED lighting rigs, so you can do it effectively at cost, or at the other end of the scale, we get commissions to make beautiful installations that people are prepared to pay us for our time. LEDs, they're not the cheapest way of lighting from scratch, but because they last long, they're virtually indestructible and they save you so much power, they're definitely cost effective.
Well, the colour lights are nice, but the white ones I'm not so keen on. I think in a way that it's a sort of cold light that they give out, isn't it? I mean, not necessarily the best way to be, maybe as a sort of temporary solution, but what are your thoughts about the actual quality of the light itself that comes from an LED?
The white that is produced by most LEDs is effectively a blue light that is then filtered with a phosphor filter to introduce a lot of yellow into it. 5 years ago, I'd have totally agreed with your statement. The light was white, blue, white, actinic, glaring, not pleasant on the eyes. But if you look a little closer at the LEDs that are available today, you'll see warm white, which is a lot more conducive living with. We tend to take lights round to people's environments and show them with our portable kits what they're actually going to be getting. And we get about 95% of people want the warm white that's available now. Some people still like the clinical bright white, but they tend to be, you know, scientists, people who are doing really hard, fiddly work.
We could call it dentist white or something.
You could call it dentist white or doctor white or... Yes, you get more lumens, more brightness for your power, the whiter the light is. So you're playing off. You won't get as much illumination on a warmer white bulb. And some people want as much light as possible for that.
It's obviously much less, takes a lot less energy to drive these LEDs, but it won't necessarily make a big difference on your lighting bill at home for your electric bill. Do you find that there is a bit of a difficulty in people transferring from the traditional low energy light bulbs over to LEDs in there for home use? Because we've seen quite a lot of people now putting solar panels on their roofs, and you might think, well, actually the LEDs are more suited to that sort of low power that those solar panels are producing, not necessarily to the high voltage supply that's coming in on the grid.
The initial premise that it doesn't seem worthwhile changing to LEDs is, well, that's not really true. You're going to save, for instance, in your kitchen, if you take out halogen light bulbs, those white spot, very hot spotlights that you tend to have in kitchens and maybe in bathrooms, they're 50 watts each. You can replace them with a 3.5-watt LED with the same brightness characteristics. So you're in a kitchen, you're probably saving maybe up to a kilowatt a day in electricity, which, okay, may only be 10p, but that's 70p a week, and that's 50 quid a year, 40 quid a year. Just by doing that one conversion, take that throughout your whole house, that will make a big difference. The quote we got from The Guardian a few years ago was, if we all turn to LEDs to illuminate our lives, we could shut 8 power stations.
Incredible. So you're LED fantastic. How do people find you? Can they find you online, or you know, whereabouts in the country are you?
Yeah, we're based in West Yorkshire, a place called Hebden Bridge, but we are mobile. We do festivals. We've got a van. It's got LEDs. It's got solar panels and batteries, and we do like to travel.
Is that that's what as headlights, or have you got proper old fashioned headlights on the front of your van?
We have got proper old headlights on the front of our proper old van. We've got LED reversing lights, but if you put LED indicators in, the telltales don't work because the vehicle thinks that the lights are broken because they're not taking enough power out of the system.
Well, this smart electronic modern cars, isn't it? It's telling that, yeah, so it says that the bulb's broken because it's not taking enough power.
That's about the size of it, yes. So you can find us online at www.ledfantastic.com or .co.uk if you like that. And we're pretty good at answering emails quickly and building a conversation with folks so that we can quickly get to solutions. Yes, we can help you refit your house, but we can also do all sorts of interesting installations or sort out workshops. Come and teach you how to do your LED lighting. Look out for us on the festival circuit. Get in touch.
Dave Brooks, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That was Ben and Dave from the Green Energy Exploration Dome. You'll find them at festivals all over the country, obviously quite regularly down here in the southwest, since the Energy Exploration Dome is actually based up in Gloucestershire.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Review now, and I'm joined by Jason Yannakopoulos for that. Jason, hi, and welcome to Dialect again.
Hey, Tony.
Now, first of all, let's have a look at the floods. This has been affecting everybody. Any idea about the cause of it? Does Private Eye help us with what's caused them all? I mean, the Somerset levels have been hit one of the worst places in the country, but although not quite as bad by wind as the southeast, apparently.
Well, it doesn't give any on that, but it does suggest a few things here. David Cameron, standing outside a flooded village pub in Yalding in Kent, claimed there are a lot of flood defences being built, but we have to do more. He is backed up here by Environment Secretary Owen Paterson, who said that 550 job cuts are being made for flood prevention, and saying this government is spending more on than all preceding governments on flood defences.
Not spending more than preceding governments is on redundancy payments for people who are supposed to be protecting us from floods.
Well, yeah, it's not only that, but the fact is that what Owen Paterson says is actually incorrect.
Oh.
As has been pointed out, one fee by the Private Eye, in 2007, National Audit Office said it would take an extra £150 million a year to reach the target of keeping just 63% of existing flood defences up to scratch. Since Coalition have come to power in 2010, they've actually spent less on flood defences. A briefing paper last year found that a 6% overall fall in central government funding for flood and coastal defences. It's also pointed out that even the extra £120 million announced in November 2012, after it was revealed that 294 flood defences were on hold, still won't bring spending back up to the 2010 levels.
Oh dear. So it wasn't surprising, though, when Mr Cameron went to Yalding that he had a member of the public getting rather annoyed with him. I don't know if Private Eye mentioned that, do they, Jason?
Unfortunately not.
No, it's a shame, but that's what, a shame. That's what happened.
It happens when you go to public faces and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and you're the Prime Minister who's cut back the flood defences and everyone's getting rather annoyed because their homes have been flooded. You would expect that some people would be a little bit vociferous.
You're going to get some wrath, yeah.
Well, he could get a bit of wrath. As far as I know, she didn't actually throw anything at him, apart from a few choice words that he should get out of their village immediately. Anyway, so that was quite, in a way, entertaining to see the Prime Minister treated in such a way on a day where people are rather fed up with the fact that he has the cheek to come and talk to people who've been victims of floods when his government have been cutting back massively on the Environment Agency and other groups. I've seen another figure which says there's 1,500 job losses at the Environment Agency, something like 700 of which are directly related to flood defences that are being cut.
Just one more thing here. The government want to encourage something called Flood and Coastal Resilience Partnership funding. The idea is basically building housing developments on floodplains and then getting the public to pay for their own flood defences.
Oh, no. I noticed, the Canesham floodplain, the old Cadbury's factory there, there's been several projects over the years to build houses on there. Now, I noticed again that they were planning, I mean, this is what I'm talking about, going back about 8-10 years, there was a front page of the Bristol Evening Post showing the entire area where they were about to build. This is, we're talking about probably 2005, completely flooded. And then that was such a long time ago that there were, again, plans to build housing on that area had started to come through again. People said, oh, don't do me silly. No, what, this area won't flood. And then, of course, over Christmas, it flooded again. So it's amazing how do these housing developers get their heads around this? Do they think, well, maybe if we go in the spring, build the houses and sell them by the autumn, that we won't get them flooded while the people are actually buying them?
Yes, that's probably the way it works, actually.
You have to get in there with a quick house building crew, get the houses built, sell them before anyone realises that they've just bought a house where they might not be able to use the downstairs.
In Greece, they managed this a lot better because they built all the villages actually on the mountain rather than in the valley at the bottom.
Hey, that sounds like a good idea. Yeah, excellent idea. Okay, moving on to tax avoidance, as we often do on this programme. There's more in Private Eye, Jason, apparently, about this wonderful topic where the rich don't get to pay any tax and the poor get to pay it all.
It's Vodafone this time.
Oh, my favourite company occupy their office.
Vodafone. Good idea. Vodafone's attempt before the Christmas to position themselves on the side of angels, almost extolling its transparency on tax payments. However, as Private Eye points out, that Vodafone likes to lump together all these taxes that are hard to avoid, national insurance contributions, etc., and then claim a huge credit for paying them. When asked by the Private Eye how much corporation tax it paid last year, Vodafone refused to say, but as we've covered in the past, Vodafone keeps its UK and global corporation tax bill down to a minimum via multi-billion pound financing arrangements run through Luxembourg.
So what they're saying is that they are making a big thing of the fact that they are paying some of the other payments that they are supposed to, they have to have, and that we should be happy and content with that.
Yeah, so the way Vodafone are sort of doing this is that all sort of pretty much 20 Vodafone companies are run through a scheme called Vodafone Luxembourg 5 Saal, located in Luxembourg, clearly. Loans of $27 billion to the group's US operations, which seem to be sold, are an interest of around 9%, transfer of $2.4 billion a year of group profit into the Luxembourg company. Once the $27 billion has been parked in a cubbyhole, fasting for a finance branch in Switzerland for a few days a year, it torches Luxembourg wealth tax there. The company is left with an annual tax bill of around 0.01%.
Amazing. So, I mean, do the government of Luxembourg not take any tax? You're saying it's not paying wealth tax in... What they're doing is they're moving the money around in such a way so they don't actually have to pay any tax on it at all.
Pretty much. When the Private Eye phoned the office in Luxembourg last year asking to speak to somebody who's representing this impressive undertaking, as they put it, a man whose CV showed him as being an assistant company secretary at an entirely different Luxembourg company answered, "Yes, well, that could be me, actually," and then refused to say any more.
Well, they may as well be running all their operations out of some kind of dodgy banana republic.
They might,
but Luxembourg isn't like that. They seem to be quite wealthy, the Luxembourgians, since they're managing to attract... Isn't this the way that the City of London historically attracted so much wealth to the city by being the most dodgy place in the world to keep your money, where they wouldn't tax you and you could do all sorts of things that you couldn't do anywhere else? The other thing, of course, is offshoring, isn't it? Where you actually have got a bank account in a City of London bank, but it's not actually in the City of London. It's considered Cayman to be Island. Offshore somewhere.
Yeah.
So it's bizarre, isn't it, how you can have a bank account in the City of London, but actually it's not in the City of London, even though it is in the City of London, because if it was in the City of London, you might have to pay tax. So that's why they say it's not in the City of London, even though it is in the City of London. How bizarre.
I hope we got all that.
Trying to simplify things. Sometimes I make it sound even more complicated. Anyway,
yes.
Well, that's the way they like it, isn't it? They're going to make it sound incredibly complicated. So the tax man says, oh, I can't handle this, scratches his head and walks off. Anyway, New Year's honours.
New Year's honours, and it's almost like the New Year's honours roulette, or New Year's dishonours, as a private more accurately puts it. Some of the people who have got honours in the New Year's honours...
Well, they're not implying, are they, that to be given a knighthood is actually something to be ashamed of, so that knighthoods are only given to people who do something to sort of pierce the public mind or do something kind of against the public, well, then they may get an honour.
Well, of course not. Would they do a thing like that?
No, of course not. No, you're quite right.
Yes. Knighthood went to PR guru Alan Parker. He's done a lot of PR work for the government.
Public relations guy for the government gets a gong.
Yeah. CB went to, guess who? That's right, it's Karen Brady, the woman who's been praising Osborne for a while and indeed introduced him at the Conservative National Convention. The chairman of the Conservative National Convention, Emma Pidding, got a CBE. Roger Gifford, who is the lobbyist for the bankers and outgoing Lord Mayor of London, got a gong. Got a gong. He got a knighthood. Among other people was CBE for Virgin Money CEO Jane Anne Gadia. I may have pronounced that wrong. For CBA for services to banking, she led Virgin's takeover for Northern Rock, of which taxpayers made a £480 million loss. Because she did it by buying Northern Rock, using money from that was actually in Northern Rock already.
Okay, so how much taxpayers' money do I have to lose, roughly, before I stand a chance of getting a knighthood?
Jane and Gadia only got a CBE for £480 million, it'd have to be a lot more than that.
Okay. Should we say a billion? I think maybe if I can manage to lose £1 billion.
Hang on. National Grid executive Nick Winter gets a CBE. He made a £3 billion profit when his own electricity transmission company was privatised in 1990. His salary is £1 million. So there you are. The CEO of the National Grid, leader of National Grid, gets a CBE. So. Well, I'm sure that all the people who have been struggling with energy recently are absolutely thrilled about that.
As well. I mean, it all goes to make a nice medal for the guy in charge of the public utility that's been privatised, doesn't it? They must have quite a lot of medals by now, these people. There's one other little fact, Jason. I don't know what you make of this, to do with the energy companies. And I mean, I know National Grid isn't exactly an energy company, but they're not far away. Is the fact that if you've got £10,000, spare hanging around like a lot of rich people do, you can invest that into one of the energy companies that it supplies you your electricity, and that £10,000 will then pay off the dividends, the share dividends that you get will then pay your electricity and gas bill for you. So by putting that £10,000 with your electricity, gas, energy company, you then no longer have to pay any electricity or gas. The dividends from your shares will just pay that for you. So your gas bill is free forever.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Isn't that good, especially for rich people? It's a good idea to reward rich people like that in order to make sure that it encourages the poor people who have to pay massive electricity bills going up all the time to become rich people. It's a sort of incentive scheme.
Yeah.
Maybe not the nicest kind of one. But then the other thing is, of course, once you've finished, after, say, 20 years, you decide, right, I want to cash, get my money back now, you get a massive bonus on that too. So your shares will have risen in value, and so it's a big investment. You may get double your money, in fact, that you put your £10,000 in, you get £20,000 out.
That's interesting. I mean, just to cap off this bit for the New Year's dishonours, any of my student friends from UWE will be delighted to learn that Ed Smith, the chairman of the Students Loans Company, was given a CBE for services to higher education.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what did he do? Do you know anything about him? Is he a super chap?
Well, not really. Student Loans Company, notorious for being late in delivering student loans and also disability payments, so... Pretty late, never quite doing the full job.
Oh, that's a pity. We've got also Francois Hollande has been in the news, hasn't he, this week?
Francois Hollande, yes.
Are you a big fan of him, or were you, or are you, or are you starting to lose faith like the French people seem to be, and like we seem to do with all of our politicians too?
Well, it is sort of almost like a trust damage. It's weird though, because the French people didn't seem particularly bothered about the fact he'd had an affair. That this seems to be normal to the French. That was quite odd. I mean, well, they'd seen it with their previous premier, with Nicolas Sarkozy,
That's right. I mean,
Carlo Bruni, while he was...
I mean, I don't understand quite why our London-based media don't get it, but they go over to France, they talk to people on the streets, what do you make of this? And they say, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And they say it again and again. What, there is much more important things to do with the future of our country.
Well, I think it's because the French media and the French public haven't been as Americanized as the British.
Well, possibly. I'm afraid I'm a bit of a suspicious chap, and I wonder, well, what is it that the French military are trying to get him to do at the moment, where they're using this as a sort of stick to beat him with, putting stuff out in the media?
It would possibly be anything to do with sending troops to Africa, but...
maybe he's not sending enough troops.
More troops going to Africa.
That's so cynical, honestly, aren't we? But I wonder, I mean, there may be some truth to it. This is the incredible thing. You know, it does wonder.
All the issues at the moment with the Central African Republic, and there's almost civil wars going on over there.
A lot of these places, of course, are like Mali, you know, former French dependencies, and Algeria. If you want to see a country that's had a terrible colonial past, Algeria is a good one, an interesting one to look at. And Al Jazeera, the TV station, the English version of that, have done some very good versions of that. Anyway, on now to gangs and Freemasonry, because that's been in The Independent this week. A big feature, only in The Independent. Nobody else has picked up on it, but it's explosive stuff, Jason.
This is wonderful. This is on Monday. It's... How gangs used Freemasons to corrupt the police. So we've covered Freemasons in past editions of Dialect. Here it says secret networks of Freemasons have been used by organized crime gangs to corrupt the criminal justice system, according to a Metropolitan Police report leaked to The Independent. Operation Tiberius, written in 2002, found underworld syndicates use their contacts in the controversial Brotherhood to recruit corrupted officers inside Scotland Yard, and concluded it was one of the most difficult aspects of organised crime corruption to prove against.
Well, that's right, because Freemasonry's the membership lists are kept secret, even though time and time again the government or through parliamentary committees have tried to get them to reveal them.
Well,
I mean, this is the second big revelation over the last couple of years to do with Freemasonry and the police. The other one I remember was Andy Davis on Channel 4 News talking about something called Project Riverside. These Masonic lodges, which are basically small cults where people swear oaths of allegiance to Freemasonry.
Project Riverside is covered later in the article.
Oh, is it? Okay.
It says Project Riverside, which was in 2008, into rogue private private investigations industry by the Serious Organised Crime Agency. It also claimed criminals attempt to corrupt the police through Freemason members in a bid to further their interests. In 1998, the then Home Secretary, Jack Straw, tried to bring an order that all police officers and judges should declare membership to Freemasons if they have it. However, 10 of the 43 police forces refused to take part, and the policy was dropped under threat of legal action.
So the police, the Home Secretary told them that if you're a Freemason in the Criminal Justice Service, you must declare that you are, or whether you are or not, and the various police authorities just failed to cooperate. I find that unbelievable.
Yeah.
Maybe there are quite a lot of Freemasons in senior positions in these various police forces that refused to cooperate, and they didn't want to reveal that they were.
Yeah,
I mean, after all,
it's worrying.
The police services are supposed to be independent, aren't they? So I can see why they might wish to say, well, we don't want to comply with that. They're supposed to be each various police, you know, national police area is supposed to be totally independent. I think our final item this week is going to be looking at Iraq war crimes. This is in The Independent as well. A devastating dossier on abuse by UK forces in Iraq has gone this week to the International Criminal Court. Details allegations of beatings, electrocution, mock executions and sexual assault. It's been presented to the International Criminal Court and could result in some of Britain's leading political and defence figures facing prosecution for systematic war crimes. Some of the people named are General Sir Peter Wall, who is head of the British Army, former Defence Secretary Jeff Hoon, and former Defence Minister Adam Ingram are among those named in the report, entitled The Responsibility of UK Officials for War Crimes Involving Systematic Detainee Abuse in Iraq from 2003
to 2008. And what they're alleging in this, it took 2 years to prepare this report, is that these war crimes, that basically nod and a wink saying, yes, get on with it, went right to the top, Jason.
Well, that's something, isn't it?
Hasn't really been reported much, apart from denials.
Really.
Interestingly enough, denials. There's been, BBC have reported it as William Hague says, there's nothing to see here.
Well, yeah, that is surprising. I mean, the Conservatives haven't taken the opportunity to take a bash at the opposing party and Labour's record. On the other hand, of course, the Conservatives also voted for the war in Iraq along with Labour.
That's right. It's strange, isn't it? Because you thought if there was any real political discourse in this country, that the Conservatives would have stuck the knife into Labour there, but they just completely ignored it. In fact, they were backing up Labour in some weird fashion. I thought you were going to ask me who brought this complaint, and I'm going to tell you anyway. It's the culmination of several years' work by Public Interest Lawyers, PIL, and the European Centre for Constitutional and Human Rights, ECCHR. It calls for an investigation into these alleged war crimes under Article 15 of the Rome Statute. So they're saying basically that these people should go to the International Criminal Court and should be tried and, if necessary, jailed.
So have we ever had a defence secretary jailed for war crimes in the past?
I'm not sure. Maybe you have to go back to the time of Queen Elizabeth or something. I think she used to just stick people in the Tower whenever she felt like it, didn't she?
But it is interesting, isn't it? I mean, this would be an absolute first should Jeff Hoon be convicted. First time a former member of Parliament or indeed a former member of the Cabinet.
Well, one of the interesting things, of course, is the way that the Chilcot inquiry into the Iraq war and how it was all started has just ground to a halt. No one seems to have noticed that it hasn't come to any conclusions. It's not delivered its report. So maybe there's a few embarrassing things in there.
Actually, that's a really good point.
Okay. Anyway, Jason, thanks very much. See you next week.
Always a pleasure, Tony.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Just finally this week, though, I'm having a look at my credit cards. And Jason and our engineer Dave Bazanko and I have all been having a look at our credit cards. Get yours out. That is your credit card now, or maybe a bit later if it's not convenient. And then have a look on it to see if you've got this little wave sign. That looks like a sort of like waves, radio waves. Four little concentric circles going in just in one direction, because that will tell you whether your debit card or credit card has got an RFID chip in it. They've started introducing these things now, and I've compared a few of people's different credit and debit cards, and we're finding that from roughly the middle of 2014, most of the cards that are valid after that have got these RFID chips in. Now, the way you can tell it, you can't tell it by looking at it, I don't think, but you certainly can tell to see if it's got this kind of wave sign. My old current account debit card used to say current account in the top right hand corner. The new one doesn't say anything, it's just got one of these little wave signs. Now, this RFID chip is a little bit of a worrying thing. There were news stories last year that at Marks and Spencer's, people with these RFID cards, which are called contactless cards, can just simply walk past a checkout terminal and end up paying for somebody else's goods, or else goods that haven't actually even been sold. So beware with these cards. It seems the only way you can actually sort of make sure that someone isn't taking payments as you walk past them is to put it in some sort of like Faraday cage in your pocket. In other words, having some sort of metal insulation to stop the radio signals going backwards and forwards between the terminal, the credit terminal or whatever, and your card. Now, I complained to my bank, the Co-op, and they said, oh, you've just got to have it. I don't want it. I said, well, they said, you've got to have it. And it's also gone to the banking ombudsman, who has made an interim judgment saying, you've just got to have it. There ain't no choice. Well, I think there should be a choice. The other thing is you can look at your credit card and each side of it, if you have a look at the little chip on it, the old ones have only got three or four panels in them. This is the little silver chip thing, whereas the RFID ones have got five in. That is the contactless payment cards. So this is something which is being brought in without any kind of consent, and it's just important that you're aware that if you're walking past Marks and Spencer's or another company that's it hasn't actually got the correct equipment or isn't doing its job properly, you may have money taken from your account and you don't even know it. So that's the contactless payments and debit cards and credit cards. A little bit of useful information for our listeners.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our studio guests, Lou Jones and Huri Betui, and also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. You'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That phone number again, 0117 989 7733. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling. Wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
wasn't that wonderful? I've turned that up so loud I've nearly blown my stupid head off. Hold on a second. That's Aulus Mobile from the LP Stop Arrête from Jimmy's Productions. Indeed, it's the title track from it.